Take your time. Mr. Patterson's here for the appellants. We have Ms. Bitzer and Ms. Collins here for the appellees. Mr. Patterson, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Grant Patterson for the plaintiffs, and I think this case is important because it gives the court an opportunity to clarify what the pleading standard is when it comes to teacher on student sexual harassment cases, especially in the context of Title IX and Section 1983. Why is this important? Because school officials have to be held accountable for sexual abuse of students. And if this decision is allowed to stand, that's going to effectively impose the heightened pleading requirement that has been expressly rejected by this Supreme Court and by this court in the Title IX and 1983 context. Instead of reading the complaint as a whole and considering the allegations together, the lower court instead weighed the believability of individual fact allegations.
I just want to jump to something that's seems like it'd be easy to plead. I mean, don't you have to plead that the university or administrator was on notice of the harassment? It seems like it'd be really easy to do that. You just say, like, we met at this day and told somebody about it. And isn't that not in here?
I'm sorry, what was the last part of that question?
Yeah, I mean, I looked through the complaint. I read the complaint many times. It looks like you do say that you put the university on notice in December of 2020, but then the university removed the coach and like a month later. So,
yes, Your Honor, thank you for your question. So there's multiple instances where the plaintiffs allege that the university had noticed, that appropriate officials at the university had noticed of Ms. Rydell's propensity for sexual harassment, which is what is required by Broward and Gebzer. And this is not just with December 2020. That goes back to the date she was hired. We state in the—
Yeah, and so that's, I guess that's the issue. The question is not whether the district court read the complaint in a light not favorable to you. To me, the question is whether the stuff that you said in the complaint, it actually put the university on notice of anything. I mean, can't we address that?
Sure.
Okay. So why is when they hired her, where in the complaint do you say that when they hired her, they knew that she had sexually harassed students in the past and was likely to do so in the future?
Sure. So at the beginning of the fact sections in the complaint, I can't recall the specific page number off the top of my head, but it's right at the beginning of the fact section. We state that Coach Meeks Rydell had a prior reputation of sexual harassment and physical, psychological, inappropriate behavior. That's one of the core bases of our belief that the university knew about this because then it's also paired with the fact that her sexually inappropriate behavior was open and obvious throughout the complaint. There's multiple instances where this is done in the presence of others, not just the teammates, not just the assistant coaches, but coach or assistant director Frisbee and more.
Okay, well, where is that in the complaint? Assistant Frisbee and more.
In the fact section, there's an allegation. I can get the specific references.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, it would really help because this is a long complaint. You make a lot of allegations that don't really have anything to do with sexual harassment. It would help if you could identify the specific parts of the complaint that you're saying make these allegations. So maybe that's something you can look at when you sit down.
Sure. And I think just to piggyback, if you could tell us, again, this is not a quiz show, so not now, but when you stand back up, the allegations that are sufficiently precise so as not to be conclusory or impermissibly vague under Twombly and Iqbal, that would be very helpful.
Can I ask for some clarification? Are there any particular allegations that you have in your head that you think aren't sufficiently?
For my purposes, sure. It's anything that gets you deeper in time than December 2020. Because if all we're talking about is December 2020, then I think you've got a real deliberate indifference problem because, as Judge Brasher says, they removed her within a month. So I think you need to move the timeline back.
Right.
Now, Judge Brasher may have different ideas about precisely what he wants.
Can I add something to that equation?
Please.
With regard to the coach's reputation before being hired, that is in a single paragraph that provides no specific reputation. How is the reputation earned? How widely was that reputation? Why would the university have? I mean, there's nothing. So if you can tell me how that put the university on notice of her proclivity for sexual harassment, that would help too.
Mr. Patterson, did you get it?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
And thank you, Judge Jordan. So I think before I directly answer that question, I just want to preface by emphasizing exactly what the pleading requirement is. I think one of the mistakes and mistaken interpretations of Twombly and Iqbal is that we have to plead plausible fact allegations individually of themselves. We have to prove that the university knew. I understand that we can't just make conclusory allegations, and that's not what we're doing here. But the purpose of the analysis under Twombly and Iqbal is that when you read the complaint as a whole, the question is, I believe as this court put it, and they're quoting Twombly, this court stated in American Dental, the plausibility requirement is simply that it calls for enough fact to raise a reasonable expectation that discovery will reveal evidence of the claim, not a particular fact allegation, but the claim. And I think when you read our complaint as a whole, where it's not just the December 2022 or 2020 incident, it's not just the reputation that she had prior to getting hired at the University of South Alabama. It's the fact that there's those two things. And then there's also the open and obvious pattern of her behavior, where she's doing this, she's doing things like butt pinches and inappropriate I love yous and calling players babes, and she's texting multiple players like that. There's the floor hugs that we are stating that several of the plaintiffs were subjected to. All of this stuff is out in the open. So the general question is, oh, and there's the incident in January of 2020 with plaintiff Tipping, where defendant Moore, and also to note, the court did find that defendants Moore, Frisbee, and Erdman are appropriate persons, so anything to them can count for actual notice. But going back to the January 2020 incident, the fake fine incident, as we've called it in our brief, that you don't manufacture a fake fine unless you're trying to conceal something. So it's
so here's on the, I mean, I appreciate sure. You mentioned the January 2020 because I think that allegation is sufficient to put the university on notice of something, right? You've identified something, and that makes perfect sense. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is where's the connection to sexual harassment, right? I mean, it sounds like when I read your complaint, I read a complaint about an abusive coach who is mean to students, who, you know, expects way too much of them, is just abusive. But I'm looking for something that keys this to sex. And in the January 2020, with that, I don't really see anything that links it to sex. So what's the link to sex?
Thank you for your question. So I think the link is that Caitlin Tipping was subjected to a lot of the instances of sexual harassment, the same things that many other plaintiffs were, right? She complains to, Moore, Chilcote, and Meeks Rydell learn that she's going to leave the university. And in response, come up with this fake fine and promise to make it go away if she lies. The inference is, and especially when you combine it with all the other allegations in our complaint, the inference is that it's because of the sexual harassment. Even though the other stuff can be part of it, the sexual harassment is part of that as well, a huge part of it. And I would also just direct the court's attention to some language from a case, Worthy v. City of Phoenix City, that even, and I'm saying this because even though it could be because of physical abuse or general abusive coaching tactics, it can also be because of the sexual abuse. And this court said in the Worthy case, at the motion to dismiss stage, when there's two equally plausible ways to read a complaint, the court should adopt the reading that's most favorable to the plaintiff. So when it's a 50-50 situation, and it's not like the plausibility requirement is a probability requirement anyways, right? When it's a 50-50 situation, that inference goes to the plaintiffs. So as I said before, when you read these allegations in total, I think it creates at least a reasonable expectation that when we get to discovery, we're going to reveal evidence of the claim, of each element of Title IX.
Well, I guess on the point about like we need to get to discovery, you know, it's your client, it's the plaintiff that is you're saying put them on notice in January of 2020. I guess this is comparable to the last argument we had. I mean, wouldn't your plaintiff know what she put them on notice of and have anything to say about that? It just seems odd to say that we need to get to discovery to find out what our own plaintiff told the university.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'll say that's not necessarily, that's not the argument I'm making either, right? Because that would be absurd. I think that what
we've heard worse. So.
I'm sure you have. But yes, so the difference, I think, in what I'm trying to say is that it's there's more to the story than just, and granted, I think we could have included some more particular details in our complaint. And if given the opportunity to, if this court finds that reversal is warranted, we'd be happy to amend the complaint as well. We made that request to the district court, and we just got the decision without a without as much as a hearing on the matter. It just came down. And so I think my point is that.
Although in fairness, we're already on the third amended, right?
I'm sorry.
We're already on the third amended.
Yes. But on that note, I think we have not had a chance to submit a substantive amendment. And if you look at the history of the amendments, we filed the first complaint in August 2021, I believe. The second complaint was filed shortly after that, and it added six additional plaintiffs to the total that we're at now, and then defendants Moore and Frisbee. And that amendment was as of right. In February 22, we filed a second amended complaint pursuant to a court order, because that first amended complaint we had filed with two of the plaintiffs proceeding anonymously. The district court ordered us to file another one with their names included. So, and the court and the defendants, defendant appellates even acknowledged there was no substantive changes to that second one. And then the third operative complaint for which we were dismissed, that was in response to court directives that we needed to clarify some of the things in our complaint, but substantively, nothing has changed. So to your point, I recognize that the third amended complaint might sound bad, but when you look at what actually happened, it's not a concern.
Okay, very well. Judge Jordan, do you have anything before we turn to hear from the other side?
No, thank you.
Okay, very well. You've reserved all your time for rebuttal. We took you beyond your allotted time. So you're
thank
you're,
Your Honor.
You're still good. All right, who's up first for the appellees? Ms. Bitzer?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Wendy Bitzer. I represent the University of South Alabama, three athletic administrators and two assistant volleyball coaches. Miss Celia Collins represents the head volleyball coach, Alexis Meeks Riddell. Our plan, subject to your honors areas of inquiry, is for to take my time, which I've taken 8 minutes to speak on Title IX, and then Ms. Collins will take 7 minutes to focus on Section 1983, although I would like to briefly speak to that with respect to my clients.
Can I just make sure I understand correctly? It sounds like the parties are basically in agreement that the December 2020 allegation is sufficient to give actual notice to an appropriate person.
That is what the district court found.
And then... your position is, if that's the only measuring stick, there's no deliberate indifference.
Because that's correct.
We did what we needed to do.
Correct.
So can you talk to us about the January 2020 allegation?
Yes, with respect to plaintiff Tipping. So the allegation, well, let me back up just with respect to her. There are no allegations in the complaint at all that she complained to anyone. And then the allegation with respect to the January 2020 meeting that they've alluded to, that those are in paragraphs 91 through 93 of the third amended.
So do I have it right? It's that Maddox complained about sexual abuse more than pressured Tipping to write the letter. Is that the allegation from the complaint?
You said Maddox?
Maddox. Complained about, or so, well, forgive me if I've got the name wrong.
Sobolewski.
Sobolewski is the
January.
Sobolewski
and Maddox had a meeting. No, Sobolewski and Maddox had a meeting in December of 2020 with Joel Erdman. and Jenny Frisbee. And that is during that meeting, yeah. Sobolewski made the allegations of sexual harassment.
Okay.
That's what the district court found, that she actually provided substance from which, you know, they could receive actual notice. So this backs up. Tipping is, there are eight plaintiffs. There are a lot of Hannahs.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is in January 2020, you just said there's no allegation that Tipping
right.
did anything.
That's right. Tipping has not alleged that she's ever complained. Okay. And she's the one who's the subject of the January 2020 meeting where Meeks Rydell and Moore are alleged.
So then just remind me, what does the complaint say about how it is that Tipping came to be pressured to write this letter?
The allegation is that upon learning that she was compelled to withdraw from the volleyball team and the university due to the defendant's wrongful conduct, they scheduled a meeting in January of 2020, during which Moore and Meeks Rydell falsely declared she'd be fined for leaving, and in an effort to conceal conduct from the NCAA, they would take care of it if she penned a letter stating she was leaving due to Australian fires, rather than the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse and harassment that she had suffered as a result of defendant's wrongful conduct. And the district court correctly concluded that is a conclusory statement and falls short of raising a reasonable inference that Tipping or others placed Moore, and he's the administrator in that scenario, regarding alleged sexual harassment. And there's no allegation that Tipping, or anyone else for that matter, complained to Moore about sexual abuse or harassment.
Yeah. Can I ask one follow-up? Just so I'm clear, in the language you were just reading at the very beginning, you said they scheduled a meeting with Moore. Who's the they? Tipping and who?
I don't have the full complaint in front of me, but...
I've got it in front of me. I'll read it to you.
Okay. It's paragraphs 91 through...
Yeah, paragraph 91 says this. Upon learning that plaintiff Tipping was compelled to withdraw from the volleyball team and the university due to defendant's wrongful conduct, defendants Chilcote, Moore, and Meeks Rydell scheduled a meeting with plaintiff Tipping in January 2020. During the January 2020 meeting, defendants Moore and Meeks Rydell sought to intimidate and manipulate plaintiff Tipping by falsely declaring that she would be fined over $6,000 for leaving the university. 93 says, in order to perpetuate the physical and emotional abuse and sexual harassment and conceal the such wrongful and illegal conduct from the NCAA, and therefore also keep such conduct out of the public eye, defendants Moore and Meeks Rydell convince plaintiff Tipping, yada, 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 write the letter. So, to just follow up on Judge Newsom's question, why isn't that enough to say that defendant Moore was put on notice of this because he was involved in that meeting and he is alleged to have done these things to try to cover up what Meeks Rydell was doing?
So there are no allegations about what he knew, what the scope of the alleged sexual harassment is, or even for that matter, what the scope of a physical or emotional.
Yeah, the allegations aren't about specific to what he knew, but they say that he sought to intimidate and manipulate her and falsely declared that she would have to pay this fine and that he did all this to cover up the previous things that they've said happened to her. So why isn't that read in the favor of them enough to say that you can't manipulate and abuse someone and seek to cover up something if you have no knowledge about what's going on, right? So that you sort of have to read into it a little bit, but that's what they say.
Well, I know that's what they say, but our position as the district courts was that it was entirely conclusory and there's no allegation anywhere in the complaint about anybody complaining to Chris Moore, what the content of that was, such that he had actual knowledge of sexual harassment or sexual abuse. I would like to go back to some of the other, and if January 2020 is... that is one of the items that they have listed that they suggest provides actual notice. And Mr. Patterson talked about reputation. And I like this court in your questioning. It seems to me that there is a general consensus that is a generalized conclusory allegation. And certainly, I think it's important, too, to note that with respect to the reputation, they only plead that upon information and belief. And so the court's not required to accept that as true. And there's no alleged facts to substantiate what the reputation was, where it came from, or the facts and circumstances. The other complaints that they raise and the district court addressed were complaints from parents. A couple of complaints from parents, one with respect to Hannah Johnson in February of 2019, but she had just suffered a concussion from getting hit in the head with a volleyball. And the allegation is that her mother called Jenny Frisbee and expressed concern about improper practices relating to health and safety. That is not sufficient, Your Honors, to put the university, give them actual knowledge of sexual harassment.
Can I ask you a broader question? Do you concede that some of the allegations in this complaint are of sexual harassment? Because I've read a lot of these things, and this one just doesn't seem, it seems harassing, but I'm having a hard time finding the sexual nature in it.
Well, that's part of the problem with the complaint. And as Your Honors mentioned before, they're the masters of their complaint. And in fact, as Mr. Patterson said before, you know, or maybe it was Judge Newsom who alluded to this, that this is information that would be knowledge that they have. And if they complained about sexual harassment, they had the ability to put that in the complaint. And with respect to this being the third amended complaint, it is the third amended complaint, but they did have notice and opportunity to fix this complaint. In fact, we moved to dismiss the first amended complaint, and the magistrate judge issued an R&R and said it was a shotgun pleading, and also noted that it was filled with labels and conclusions and they needed to fix it. So they have had an opportunity to correct the pleading. And when they pleaded and submitted the third amended complaint, it's now 150 pages, but it's replete with even more labels and conclusions.
Can I ask you one more question before we turn to Judge Jordan? If we were to conclude that the allegation concerning the January 2020 incident was sufficient to put an appropriate person on actual notice, then how does your deliberate indifference argument change with respect to that timeline? If you're at December 2020, you know, it seems to me, speaking for myself, you're in pretty good shape because you took care of things within a month. What if we reverse the calendar almost a full year?
Well, at this point in time, there are no allegations in the complaint, and that's all we can, you know, derive and speak to. We haven't had discovery about what happened in between, so we're just, you know, resting with what's alleged in the complaint.
But I mean, is your position nonetheless that as a matter of law, even if court you conclude that the notice was given in January 2020, nonetheless, we were not deliberately indifferent because?
Well, we haven't had an opportunity to say what the university did or did not do.
Okay.
At this point in time.
Okay. That's helpful. Judge Jordan, do you have anything for Ms. Bitzer?
I don't. Thank you.
Could I speak for, am I over time?
You're over.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. Very well. Thank you so much. All right. Ms. Collins, let's hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Please court. My name is Celia Collins. I'm attorney for defendant Alexis Meeks Rydell. The question with respect to my client is whether Judge Dubose properly dismissed the claim against her for violating the substantive due process rights of the appellees. We submit that under the precedent of the United States Supreme Court and this court, her ruling is fully supported. The appellees allege a plethora of wrongful conduct by my client in the course of her role as the head coach of their team at University of South Alabama. These include very broad allegations of sexual abuse and physical abuse. The basic allegations they allege, however, are enhanced and made to sound worse by various legal conclusions, unsupported, conclusory, and inflammatory characterizations. The Supreme Court has told us the complaint must be analyzed under the standards as set forth in Bell Atlantic v. Twombly and Ashcroft v. Iqbal. The basic principles of these cases.
Sorry. Yes, Judge Jordan has a question.
Okay.
From my perspective, the allegations against your were not conclusory in any way. They may not have stated a substantive process, but there's no doubt about what your client said to the bus. Am I wrong about that?
I'll ask the question. He says that there's no doubt about what your client is alleged to have done to these children.
That's the question before this court.
Well, I don't have a doubt about it. I mean, I read the complaint. So.
No, the question is the substance. I think what he was saying, does it allege a substantive due process claim?
Yeah.
Yes, and we agree. There were civil claims alleged. We actually answered those in the initial complaint because there was enough alleged to withstand 12b-6. The substantive due process was another matter, which is why we proceeded with a motion to dismiss that. And again, under the Twombly and Iqbal.
Well, I think you may be mixing buckets here. It seems to me, Judge Jordan's question is, there's enough specificity in this complaint with respect to what your client did. Now let's talk about whether that violates the substantive due process doctrine. Yeah. So I think in response to that question, I think you don't want to say Twombly and Iqbal. You just want to say, let's talk about
understand.
The law. Yeah.
Okay, so let me get to that point. So for substantive due process, and in this case, they allege that she violated their substantive due process with respect to their bodily integrity. The conduct they describe in the complaint is basically in two categories. One is what I would call physical, the hard training sessions, the early morning practices, coercing them to play through injuries. The other category is the sexual, if indeed it is, butt pinches when they exited the bus and away games, telling them she loved them and asking them to say it back, floor hugs, etc. All of this conduct in their allegations is alleged to have occurred entirely within the context of volleyball, training, games, coach-player relationship. Under both Supreme Court law and 11th Circuit precedent, both courts all recognize that the court should be cautious in recognizing substantive due process claims. They've said again and again, 1983 is not a font of tort law to convert state law claims into federal claims. Only the most egregious conduct qualifies, and even intentional wrongs seldom evaluate the due process claim. That's what the courts say. The relevant test, according to the courts, is whether it's conscience shocking. In a series of cases, in somewhat similar
let me just cut you off and just tell you where I think the best claim that they have for a conscience shocking bodily integrity claim is. It's with the girl who, and I think it's DeMarcus, who was forced to practice so hard that she developed a heart condition that required her to undergo surgery. What is your best argument that doesn't rise to the level of a substantive due process violation?
Based on 11th Circuit precedent, there have been several cases in the sports practice game setting where the coach pushed them so hard they ultimately died. And even in those cases, the court has said that's not enough to be conscience shocking.
Here's the one difference, I would say, between this case and those cases. And I'm not sure it's a difference that makes a difference, but it's a difference. It's a difference that makes a difference, yeah. They say here that it was the team physicians this is what they say. I'll just quote it because I don't want to add anything to it. They say, despite the concerns of team physicians, defendant Meeks Rydell coerced and forced plaintiff DeMarcus to do this stuff until she developed this condition. I don't see it in any of those other cases where there was a doctor who told the coach, stop doing this, and the coach continued to do it anyway.
But didn't, I've read the cases, I don't know whether it was there or not. It wasn't mentioned, but we'll agree with Your Honor on that.
Right, so doesn't that make a difference that in those cases, it was a coach who was telling someone to practice, telling them to practice, and unfortunately they died. Here, it seems like what they're alleging is that there's a doctor who tells the coach, stop making this girl practice, and the coach says, don't care, I'm gonna continue to do it until she dies. That seems like it's a very serious problem.
But except that didn't happen. And
well, fortunately, but she didn't sit to develop the heart condition.
And according to the complaint, the girl continued to play for some period of time after that. Again, you know, whether it's bad conduct as alleged, of course, we don't agree with any of it, but as alleged or not, under the law, as the court has developed it, it just doesn't mean that stuck the conscience level. I mean, again, there are cases where in this court where football players died because the coach knowing that they were dehydrated wouldn't allow them to hydrate. I mean, what is the difference? I mean, you know,
okay,
whether it's wrong or not right, it's not a constitutional violation.
Gotcha. Okay, I think we've got your argument. Judge Jordan, do you have questions for Ms. Collins?
No, thank you.
Okay, very well. Thank you. All right, Mr. Patterson, you've got all 5 minutes of your rebuttal remaining. And just at some point during the 5 minutes, doesn't matter to me when, but you really didn't have a chance to talk about substantive due process at all while you were at the podium because we had you sidetracked on Title IX the whole time. But would you mind in your presentation at some point addressing the substantive due process issue and especially the qualified immunity gloss and how it is that you can clearly, it was, you know, demonstrate that the law is clearly established?
Yes, Your Honor. I was already ahead of you planning on doing it.
Okay.
So I've got 5 minutes. I'm going to speak very quickly. First, to address the points that you raised in earlier, the citations for notice to Frisbee is in, I believe, in the fact section, paragraphs 20. I'm sorry, this is Frisbee. First of all, this is not notice specifically to Meeks Rydell, but this does add to the volume of claims going to, it's plausible that the university had noticed that their volleyball players were going to be subjected to sexual harassment or inappropriate conduct. In paragraph 28 of the complaint, it says that due to the known inappropriate conduct of coaches from the previous regime, Defendant Frisbee promised members of the volleyball team that she would supervise the transition into Coach Meeks Rydell's coaching regime to ensure that there would be no more inappropriate conduct. I also want to add assistant coach Chilcote was also a member of that previous coaching regime. What this shows when read in the totality of the complaint is that the university knew that there were systemic fundamental flaws in their volleyball coaching program to the extent that they needed to promise their players to supervise the new coach. And then when you read into the other allegations of the complaint, this is just further evidence that the university knew that there was a problem here and that there was a substantial risk that their players would get subjected to sexual harassment. There's also a mention in February 2019 from Plaintiff Johnson in paragraph, I believe it's around 136. Yeah, she's reports to Frisbee, or her mother complains to Frisbee of the physical abuse that she endured as well. And the inference there is that because Johnson, just like the other plaintiffs, was also subjected to the same routine sexual harassment, that was part of that conversation as well. I want to respond quickly that there's no allegation. Defense counsel said that there's no allegations that Tipping complained. It doesn't matter if Tipping made a complaint. That's not the question. What matters is that the university knew, regardless of whether it's because of a complaint from the person or because they observed it or they got an anonymous tip. That's the question, whether they knew, not whether the plaintiff complained. That's very clear in the case law. And just like you said, it absolutely suggests misconduct. I want to respond to the point that the allegation about the prior history is based upon information and belief. That does not mean that the court has to discredit that allegation. That just means you can scratch through that language that says upon information and belief. Finally, to respond quickly to the point about the amendments and that we had the opportunity to amend that. The standard for amendment is that amendment should be granted or freely granted when justice requires, unless it would be futile to amend the complaint, which it's not here. And then unless there was undue delay and prejudice, discovery's not been had. And the case law says that where there's not been discovery, where the defendants haven't answered the complaint, that there's no undue delay or prejudice to either party. So the question at the end of the day is whether the complaint has enough heft. I believe that that was the court's words in Twombly to make it clear that the plaintiffs have stated a plausible claim to relief. And I think that's the case in ours. And then briefly to respond to the substance due process claims. I think what separates our case from all the other cases that have been cited by the lower court and decided by the appellants here is that this is more, and her conduct, and I'll focus, because we've talked a lot about the sexual harassment, I'll focus especially on the excessive corporal punishment claim.
And just in the minute you've got left, to be clear, you said like what makes this case different from all the others that have been cited by the other side, given the QI gloss here, I think you've got to go on offense. Like you can't just play defense against their cases, right? You've got to show I've got, you know, sort of a zinger of a case or line of cases that, you know, sort of demonstrate the rightness of my position. So like to channel my inner Lanier Anderson, our colleague on the court, I won't try to do his beautiful Southern accent, but like, what's your best case?
Sure, Your Honor, thank you. The best case is that this is way more than just an intentional report. The test for whether this is, we've established the right that we've identified, right? It's the right to bodily integrity and to be free from excessive punishment. That's a given. Whether that's clearly established, we've got cases in this circuit that establish that when a school has notice of when there's no legitimate purpose for using the punishment used, that use of corporal punishment is excessive. And that's exactly what is the case here, because there is no reason for, like Judge Brasher said, there's no reason to withhold medical treatment from a player who you see wheezing and who the trained physicians on the team know that there's a problem. And the plaintiff DeMarcus was not the only plaintiff that does that. I believe it was I can't remember off the top of my head, but there's others in there that medical trainers, they're having severe problems. They were having asthma attacks. They were denied inhalers. They had to crawl off the floor. Another plaintiff was hospitalized for 2 weeks in this instance.
So is your point from a qualified immunity perspective, I'm not writing a single case. Like there is no case on point. You're going to put yourself not in bucket one of the three buckets, but maybe in bucket two and say, there's a clearly established principle that I can deduce from a case like Neil, where the kid gets his eye knocked out of its socket. And you're saying the principle deduced from Neil is where there is no legitimate need for the use of force that is just sort of like per se conscience shocking.
Sure.
Okay. All right. So I think that's good. We've taken you over your time as well. Thank you very much for your presentation, both sides. That case is submitted. Oh, wait. I'm so sorry. Judge Jordan, do you have any further questions from Mr. Patterson?
Oh, no, thank you very much.
Okay. Sorry about that.